Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Before we begin, a quick correction. Last week, I misspoke and mischaracterized the alleged shooter of Charlie Kirk. It was not intentional. It is what we call a live radio flub. But I apologize. And now on to the roundtable. With me in the studio this week, we have Marty Schladen, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome back, Marty.
Good morning, Amy.
Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Laura.
Hello, hello.
And Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Welcome back, Andrew.
Happy Monday.
There will be no sweater vests in the governor's office. Jim Tressel is making it official. He is not running for governor. And this clears the GOP field for Vivek Ramaswamy. Andrew, what reason did Tressel give for finally deciding officially that it's not official?
He issued a statement, and it basically said he prayed about it a lot and decided it wasn't the right time. So if he had kind of other reasons for it, he didn't lay them out exactly. I'll say that he did not necessarily seem like he was laying the groundwork for running for office. When you do that, you don't have to announce that you're running, but you do have to get ready for it. And we didn't really see any signs of that, like, he wasn't hiring staff, he wasn't kind of making the rounds and getting his face out at Republican events and stuff like that. So it's not necessarily surprising, but like you said, it is kind of like the last horseshoe to drop or whatever for Ramaswamy to basically have a clear field for the Republican nomination in May.
And Laura, wasn't it, I mean, a while ago, it was a surprise when Governor DeWine picked Tressel to be the lieutenant governor to replace John Houston, who went off to the Senate. Everyone was a little surprised with that pick, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it came out of the blue. I mean, Tressel hasn't held political office before, but it also makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, he's well known around the state, very well liked, and he's got a lot of experience. And so he's a good, you know, certainly placeholder for LG.
Yeah, did you think that DeWine maybe wanted him to run for governor, even if Tressel himself didn't?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the sense that we've gotten. But mm-hmm. And also, you know, Governor DeWine has not endorsed anyone in the race. We'll see if he endorses Ramaswamy now that Tressel's definitely not running.
And Marty, Tressel was a political newcomer, but he had the kind of name recognition any candidate would kill for. I mean, the former Ohio State Buckeye coach. So do you think that if he would have done the things, maybe he would have had a chance with his because of his name recognition?
Well, I thought so, but I'm very often wrong about these things. But yeah, it was a little bit of, you know, Mike DeWine is obviously not the most MAGA Republican elected official out there. Mm-hmm. And he's had his problems with Trump in the past. And a lot of people speculated that Tressel was a way to put somebody in the field who is not just, you know, an acolyte of Donald Trump, but still a Republican and a conservative, all that sort of thing. But it looks pretty clear that Ramaswamy was able to clear the field. He had all the momentum. Mm-hmm. Labor unions are even endorsing him, saying that, you know, he's likely to be the next governor.
So just to remind listeners about the field, a while back in May, Attorney General Dave Yost dropped out of the race after losing the GOP endorsement to Ramaswamy. And then the Associated Press is reporting that Appalachian entrepreneur Heather Hill of Morgan County, she wrote on social media that she's leaving the Republican Party, but plans to continue to run for governor as an independent or third party candidate. Andrew, she's a long shot candidate. What's the motive for her staying in as an independent?
I honestly don't really know because I haven't spoken with her about that decision or anything like that. But somebody like you said, I mean, she was never seriously campaigning in the way that you have to do to really run for governor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your guess is as good as mine, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. So she left the Republican Party, but she says she's going to run as an independent. And then there's this Ohio State master's student running as an independent as well. His name is Timothy Grady, I think. So he's 28, and he had an unsuccessful writing campaign in 2022. Does anyone know anything about him?
It's kind of a shtick, basically. I mean, I get his press releases, and it's kind of like a performance art is the way that I kind of perceive it.
Hmm. I mean, these unknowns have, if Jim Tressel can't win in a GOP primary with the name recognition, he doesn't want to run. His chances are so low. You know, certainly a third party unknown is not. It's beyond a long shot.
Right. So. And then on the Democratic side, we have Dr. Amy Acton running unchallenged unless former Congressman Tim Ryan decides to make it a race. Marty, do you think he's still mulling over this decision?
I think he probably is. But he's probably also sizing up what his chances are to raise enough money, you know, what effect that will have on Ohio Democrats, all those sorts of things. I haven't spoken to him about any of this, but I would guess that he's still looking at it.
Well, Andrew, you mentioned that Jim Tressel wasn't doing all the things you do when you want to run. Is Tim Ryan doing the things you do when you want to run?
A little bit. He's been booked at some Democratic Party functions, and he's honestly kind of like fanning the flames a little bit about whether he'll run or not. That's a big part of it, which maybe sounds silly, but for instance, Tressel never really did that other than not ruling it out. So the kind of latest on Tim Ryan is that he's going to decide by the end of the month. And we've been watching Amy Acton roll out some endorsements, which are essentially, I think, aimed at kind of boxing out his support and stuff like that. So we'll see what happens there. But honestly, it's getting pretty late. And so he'll have to decide soon if he wants to make a serious campaign out of it.
All right. The end of the month. I was just like, I'm like, what day is it? I don't even know. Okay. So like 8 days. All right.
Yeah.
Duly noted. You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our weekly reporter roundtable, and we're with Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio, Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, and Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal. Moving on to redistricting.
Fair districts!
So that was the scene outside the statehouse last week with more than 100 Ohioans. They joined hands, they formed a circle around the statehouse, and the group was made up of voting rights and anti-gerrymandering advocates. My understanding is this morning, a joint committee on congressional redistricting is meeting at 11, so a little less than an hour from now. And Ohio has to create new maps because the one they adopted in 2022 did not have bipartisan support. So what are we thinking is going to happen in this meeting at 11 today? Andrew, is the meeting happening at 11 today?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm actually going to head over there after this is over. So I don't have my crystal ball out about exactly what's going to happen. But they're holding the meeting because the Constitution requires them to hold a couple of meetings at this phase. It kind of lays out rules for September, for October, for November. We're almost to October, obviously, so we're almost to the next phase of it. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that a lot of the people who are at the rally for the clip that you just played will probably be there. They don't have a map to really comment on. Democrats, a couple of weeks ago now, unveiled their proposal of a map, but Democrats don't really have the control of the driver. They're not driving the car here. Mm-hmm. So it ultimately will come down to what Republicans want to do. And until we actually have a proposal from them, it's just kind of like sitting around and talking about the issue. So I imagine we'll hear from these advocates what they want to see out of this process, but whether Republicans are actually going to give them anything to really weigh in on, I think that's unlikely at this point.
Laura, how would you assess the level of bipartisan cooperation that we're going to be heading into here after today?
I mean, if past is prologue, I'd say minimal. You know, the Republicans control the whole process. And, you know, the split right now for congressional map is 10 Republicans and 5 Democrats. Mm-hmm. The Democrats proposed a map that would be an 8-7 split. And everyone, except for the Democrats at this press conference, acknowledged that that was pretty much dead on arrival. Mm-hmm. That's definitely not going to happen. You know, even the Republicans are talking about maybe going to a 12-3 map and probably targeting the district held by Amelia Sykes up in the Akron area and the district in Toledo held by Marcy Kaptur. So, you know, we'll see. I think the whole thing where the Democrats rolled out their map was, you know, their effort to put a stake in the ground. But I think the Republicans will just steam right past that stake.
Yeah, the Democrats jump-started the process. They unveiled their map, and then House Speaker Matt Huffman was asked about it, and he definitely wasn't a fan. So Marty, where do we go from here? There's this call for citizen input on the website where citizens can, you know, create their own maps and put them up there. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think where we're headed is what Laura just described. I imagine when the actual map drawing gets done, the Republicans in charge of the process are going to seek to try to increase the number of seats they hold. It's as Andrew wrote last week, this is out of kilter with how Ohio generally breaks down in statewide elections. But that's what Donald Trump is pushing for. But they run a risk because they reduce their relative power in the districts Republicans control now. And we don't know how popular Donald Trump and his party are going to be this time next year, you know, when the voting actually happens. So it could backfire on them. But I think that they're going to do what Donald Trump says he wants them to do.
And Marty, your colleague Susan Tebben reported that the Princeton gerrymandering project gave grades to congressional maps and gave Ohio's map a D for partisanship. So, do they care that they got a D?
Well, like Laura said, if passed as prologue, no. Mm-hmm. They rejected seven. Between congressional and state maps, they rejected seven bipartisan Supreme Court decisions the last time this process was undertaken. Or I shouldn't say they rejected it. They ignored them.
Hmm. All right. Well, I guess we'll see what happens after the meeting today. But they have to release some sort of map by the 30th. Is that correct?
I don't think they – I'm actually unclear about – that's an interesting question. But they don't have to – I don't think they're going to.
Mm-hmm.
I think they may not have to. And so ultimately
they have to talk about it before the 30th.
Correct.
Right.
And they have the opportunity to approve a bipartisan map, but I don't really think that they're leaping at that opportunity at this point because they can just wait until November to get something without bipartisan approval.
Yeah, I think that today's meeting is, again, just because it's required, and then they'll move on to the next step in the board game.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to conservative activist Charlie Kirk's funeral took place on Sunday, turning out several members of the Trump administration, with President Trump speaking for 45 minutes to an overflowing crowd of tens of thousands of mourners. His widow, Erica Kirk, spoke before the president, and she forgave her husband's alleged assassin, Tyler Robinson. The president, during his remarks, honored Kirk's life and the movement and credited him with getting young people out, especially Christians, to vote for him for president.
He was assassinated because he lived bravely, he led boldly, and he argued brilliantly without apology. He did what was right for our nation. And so on that terrible day, September 10th, 2025, our greatest evangelist for American liberty became immortal. He's a martyr now for American freedom.
The memorial service highlighted how the political and the religious have fused themselves together in the administration. Vice President J.D. Vance also spoke. Andrew, any thoughts on, before we turn to how Kirk's assassination resonated in Ohio politics, any thoughts on J.D. Vance of Ohio, you know, speaking there and his relationship with Kirk?
Yeah, actually, I learned something closer to when immediately after this happened that Kirk and Vance were closer than I'd realized. Vance tweeted shortly after the assassination about how Kirk reached out to him and helped open the door that allowed him to meet Donald Trump Jr., which is kind of what gave Vance his in with MAGA world in general. And really led to where he is today. So I did not realize how kind of like personally close they were and how integral Kirk was into Vance's political career taking off like it did. So the other thought that I have on this is that close to when Vance was running for the Senate in the 2022 election, he was kind of like floating all of these acts of retribution that the right could take against the left if only they were to be able to gain power and win the election, win the White House and that kind of stuff. And after Trump was nearly killed last year, Vance was kind of out of the gate with some really kind of, you know, angry messages in social media. It was actually Trump, of all people, who kind of tamped that down. It seems that this is a real inflection point about exactly how the Trump administration is going to respond to this moment. But it just makes me think about how Vance has kind of been here all along. Mm-hmm. When they're talking about, you know, the need to, you know, like this divide that exists, like we can't really reconcile it anymore. We need to just kind of like fight for what we, you know, the values that we believe in and stuff like that. And so Vance is a really crucial figure in this. And like I said, I think it's just kind of how he's been looking at this moment even before it happened. So it's very interesting given, obviously, you know, his status as an Ohioan and kind of where he came from and all that stuff.
And then back here at home in Ohio, there's two Ohio lawmakers who want to stiffen the penalties for political violence. A bill introduced by Republican Representatives Jack Daniels and Josh Williams. The legislation comes in the wake of the recent assassination of both Charlie Kirk and Democratic Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman. Here's Representative Daniels talking about the impetus for this bill.
We wanted to allow the judicial system to use the maximum law available, the maximum penalties available.
So, Laura, there's been a number of lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats in this state, who have turned away from the death penalty as a form of punishment. There hasn't been an execution in, is it nearly 7 years or more than that?
We haven't had an execution on Governor DeWine's watch yet. Mm-hmm. And I don't see that changing. The director of Rehabilitation and Corrections, Annette Chambers-Smith, said on Friday that they're no closer to getting the drugs needed. I mean, there is some talk of changing the method of execution in Ohio. Mm-hmm. There are some Republicans that are rallying behind that. It is pretty popular, I think, when there's you know, a big news event that gets people very emotionally charged and upset to then, you know, turn to stiffer penalties and naming a bill after the person who was killed or mm-hmm. harmed. And I think that that's sort of what we're seeing here.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of people have been weighing in. Former Governor John Kasich last week wrote an opinion piece for this Dispatch, and the headline read, "Our values are shredded. Kasich calls for respect after Kirk and Minnesota killings." Marty, what do you make of just the political climate that we're in right now and how Ohio politicians are going to have to navigate it?
Well, there's a lot of bomb throwing going on. And I think it's important to be clear about that. You know, I mean, Kirk himself was a big proponent of the great replacement theory, that shadowy forces were trying to put white people in the minority in the United States. And that's been linked to political violence. Yeah, and you reap the whirlwind. I've heard people on both sides of the spectrum, you know, talking about how, you know, we've got to stand up and not just protest peacefully, and, you know, and this is what happens. You know, I saw a really interesting time story. It was like at some snap polling, right track, wrong track numbers, and a whole lot of particularly Republican women in the wake of the Kirk assassination said the country's on the wrong track. I think people are scared, and rightfully so. So I think that this, we're in a really ugly moment. I don't know how long it's going to last, but, you know, between mass shootings, assassinations, attempted assassinations, none of these things are good for us.
Something notable that happened last week, though, was the Republican and Democratic legislative leaders in Ohio issued a joint statement denouncing political violence, which sounds easy. You know, that's kind of a low bar to clear. It's really sad that that's notable on some level. But what was notable about it is that they denounced the shooting of Charlie Kirk, and they also, well, I guess the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and they also denounced the assassination of the former Minnesota Speaker of the House, Melissa Hortman, and her husband. And so we did see immediately after the assassination in Congress that people, like members of Congress, are yelling at each other. It's a very heated moment. But I guess it's good to see in kind of like this era of partisanship that, like I said, that Democrats and Republicans are able to come together on that key point, because we've kind of seen a lot of recriminations about, is this a bigger deal than that? And like that shooting, and who's responsible for it? And I think, you know, like seeing leaders at least having like a baseline that they've established together is a more encouraging sign than we've seen maybe even in Congress.
I would just add to that, you know, political violence, I think, imperils the First Amendment and democracy. It's extremely dangerous. You know, people, I think, will be chilled from expressing their opinion and their ideas. if they fear that they're going to be gunned down or harassed or, you know, lose their jobs or what have you. And, you know, so I think this is a kind of a critical point in American history right now.
Hmm. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break. But before we take a break, now more than ever, we need to put politics in its place, and we need to put aside hyper-partisanship and heated rhetoric. We need to have civil discourse, and frankly, perhaps we need a beer. That's why WOSU is hosting another Politics and a Pint. You can join me and Mike Thompson and a couple of Statehouse vets to discuss all things politics. We invite you to join us. It's Thursday, October 2nd at 7th Sun Brewing. You can register at WOSU.org/events. Coming up, Intel gets a big cash infusion from a key rival, and the woman who led Medicaid is leaving Ohio. That's when All Sides Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Laura Bischoff, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, and state government and politics reporter Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio. Each week brings fresh news about Intel, and as another large investment rolls in this time, this one comes from rival company NVIDIA, which is the world's largest chip maker. It gave a lifeline in the form of $5 billion, making it one of the largest stockholders for Intel. Andrew, what does this mean that NVIDIA is partnering with Intel? I don't even know if partnering is the right word.
Yeah, the idea is that they're going to collaborate in the future, and Intel kind of specializes in making the chips that kind of power your computer, and then NVIDIA specializes in making chips that in your computer, it's like the graphics card. It's higher, it's specialized kind of higher performance processing. And those kinds of chips have been adapted more recently to run data centers, especially the ones that power AI. It's why NVIDIA is this giant company now. And it's why Intel's fallen behind, because people aren't buying just regular computers like they used to. So in this deal, the two companies will work together to make future generations of chips. And like you said, it makes NVIDIA a big shareholder. It gives Intel some money. It's kind of the thing that everybody cares about here in Columbus, though, is whether this means the factory that Intel is building outside of Columbus is going to happen or not. I was reading this Reuters article that the CEOs, when they announced this deal, didn't specify exactly what the implications for that are. But these chips that they make together would be produced at if not the factory that they're building here, ones like it, where they're basically building, Intel wants to build chips for other companies, whereas NVIDIA kind of specializes in designing them and other companies build them for NVIDIA. So the idea is that this collaboration may mean that they're building these chips in the future at the factory here, but it's not clear if that definitely will be the case. But if nothing else, Intel is really starting to kind of like run out of money, and getting another $5 billion will help prop up the company. But whether, you know, it's hard to say exactly what this means, although we have seen these two giant investments happen in Intel in the last few months. It will be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah, the other week, President Trump announced the U.S. government would buy a 10% stake in Intel, and then came news that there was $2 billion from SoftBank, and now this $5 billion. Laura, do you think that these investments are going to make a difference for Intel? Like as Andrew said, we don't know what it means specifically for the New Albany project, but if Intel survives, maybe New Albany survives.
Yeah, it's interesting because the DeWine administration has been saying repeatedly every time we ask about Intel that, you know, so much money has been invested in that site so far. They're not going to just walk away from it, and chips will be manufactured, but they won't say it's definitely going to be Intel or some other company. I think that NVIDIA is going to own 4% of shares. The U.S. government has like a 10% stake. All of these big investments gives them cash to keep operating and try to, you know, build out this big project in New Albany and whatever else they're working on. But, you know, as you give away chunks of shares, it means that you have less control in the boardroom about, you know, controlling your own destiny, about, you know, where the company's going to go.
Yeah. And Marty, I mean, the DeWine administration put a lot into this and they're kind of on their way out. So is this going to be Vivek Ramaswamy's problem to fix?
It very well
if he wins, yes. Or Amy Acton's problem, I should say.
It very well could be either of their problems. The number that sticks out in my mind is we the taxpayers have given them something like $2 billion in incentives to build this thing. And I have not yet looked at how much of that Ohioans can recoup. But these projects, these quote-unquote economic development packages, have a kind of a sorry history when it comes to making businesses live up to their promises or pay the taxpayers back.
All right. So I guess we will see. We'll use our crystal ball, as Andrew likes to say. We'll use a crystal ball and see what happens in 2031, whether there's any chips being made in New Albany.
Yeah, hopefully we're not still asking that question, you
know, in 2031. I know, right? All right, moving on. The Ohio Medicaid director, Maureen Corcoran, is leaving the agency. Her agency oversees the state's health insurance program for low-income Ohioans with more than 3 million participants. I'm not sure who covered this, but did she give a reason for leaving?
I don't think she did. Mm-hmm. You know, I do think that as the DeWine administration comes to, you know, its end, that you're going to see more of the cabinet members hopping off for other opportunities. I think there's going to be some directors that will run out the tape with Governor DeWine, but, you know, I don't see this as any big intrigue.
Yeah. So I was wondering, like, how did she do as Medicaid director? I mean, she didn't do anything bad because I'm not, like, well, she's not this well-known household name, so.
Well, she did a big thing, and it'll be interesting to see whether her successors will try to undo it. I've written a lot about pharmacy benefit managers, and there were two of the big three were working in the Medicaid space. And when I was still at the Dispatch in 2018, we did a project where we looked at how much these PBMs were taking for themselves, and we found it was a lot. So in response, the Medicaid department did its own investigation, and they figured out that in 2017, two PBMs, CVS Caremark and OptumRx, had billed the state $224 million more for drugs than they paid the pharmacists who dispensed them. These are companies that never even touched a pill. So they undertook a massive reform effort where they created their own pharmacy benefit manager to just do the administrative stuff, but they really created a lot of transparency into what they were doing at the same time that they massively increased pharmacy reimbursements. It's still not pharmacies are still leaving the space, you know, at a pretty alarming rate, but they're getting a lot more under the Medicaid program. And even so, according to their auditors, they saved like $100-some million over 2 years. Mm-hmm. So there, I know there's pressure to get rid of that reform because these are huge corporations, but that's something that the Medicaid department did under Maureen Corcoran. And we'll see if it survives her tenure there.
Okay. And, Andrew, Medicaid is a huge part of Ohio's budget. Lots of money involved here. So DeWine will have to replace her, right? I guess there's a lot of changes coming with Medicaid when it comes to federal and state level. We don't know. A lot of the Medicaid changes don't happen until 2028. So I guess that's not even, DeWine won't even be in the administration for that.
Yeah, we made it through the budget, which is really the big challenge for Medicaid. I imagine that maybe she's even timing this until that was over. But a big thing that Medicaid a big challenge they face is just rising costs. There are a lot of things that contribute to that. And one of the things that the state tries to do in order to counteract that is to make services kind of integrate better. Like, our healthcare system's obviously very fractured. You have a lot of different providers, you know, who have to kind of like all line up and be rowing in the same direction in order to provide services to people, and especially kind of complex cases. So a big program for Ohio was the Ohio RISE program, which was meant to basically integrate, or, like, you know, this is all like a bunch of jargon, but take complicated behavioral cases, get all of the different providers on the same page, help them coordinate their care, and hopefully reduce the cost long term. So whoever takes over is going to have the pleasure of continuing to try to have those initiatives work and try to reduce long-term costs. But like you said, the federal government, as they try to get the deficit under control, are looking at dramatically decreasing payments to states. Costs keep going up. Making any changes to the system is hugely complicated just because of the number of people and organizations that are involved. So it's hard to explain. It's even harder to run. So whoever gets that job is going to have their work cut out for them.
That's what I was just going to ask. Any idea who will replace her?
We've not heard anything like that. So, but I imagine, you know, whoever the next governor is going to want to have their people in. And so it's probably going to be, you know, maybe the next person will be auditioning for the next governor, but it's maybe it'll just be
it's
like
just
a short-term
thing. Very short job. Yeah. All right. You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News for our weekly reporter roundtable. You're listening to Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio, Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, and Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch. Laura, three statewide teachers unions are suing the state teachers retirement system over changes to the board and the balance of power there. Can you catch us on what's happening with STRS?
Yeah, so the Ohio Education Association, the Ohio Federation of Teachers, and the Ohio chapter of the Association of American University Professors, maybe it's, anyway, the three big education unions, they are suing STRS over these board changes that were made in the state budget bill during the conference committee in the middle of the night. They were added to the bill, and they're saying, like, there was not a proper public reading of these changes, that it violates the Ohio Constitution's requirement that each bill deal with a single subject. I will tell you that the budget bill is
many subjects.
A prime example of how many different subjects that they cram into, you know, 4,000 pages of legislation. And also they're saying that the teachers' pension fund was targeted, or that it's like equal protection rights were violated, because the other four public pension systems, their board makeup is not going to change. It was only the STRS board. And what it's going to do is over starting, well, it was going to start at the end of the month, there's going to be a phasing out of the teachers and retirees. The balance of control will go to political appointees who are appointed by the legislature, the governor, and the state treasurer.
This is just so interesting to me, because they left the other four public pension systems alone, but then they're making these changes. And most people would be like, what does it matter that there's a board change for the state teachers' retirement system? But what does it matter? What do they do? What decisions do they make?
Oh, well, I mean, they're in charge of $95 billion.
That's a lot of money.
Invested on behalf of 500,000 teachers and retirees and their beneficiaries. So it is a very important board. These public pension systems control a ton of money. And STRS is the second largest in the state, and it's among the largest in the country in terms of public pension systems. Retirees and teachers rely on this money. It is Ohio is not a Social Security state for public employees, so this is the primary retirement benefit for them. And I think STRS got targeted because there's been a lot of controversy on that board in recent years. And they've had a revolving door of management changes. There's been kind of like a group of reformers have taken control of the board and have pressed for increased benefits and a return of the cost of living allowance for retirees. STRS put a freeze on that, and that went over very badly with the retirees, who, you know, they say that they were promised this cost of living allowance, mm-hmm. and the rug got pulled out from under them. So this is it is interesting. There's multiple lawsuits over, you know, the who's on the board and how they're operating, and there's an Ohio Ethics Commission investigation underway. No clue when that's going to get wrapped up or disclosed. So we'll see.
So are all these past board problems why lawmakers are like, we're just going to take it over? And
I don't know if it's just that. You know, as Laura said, it's a massive amount of money. And while these COLAs were frozen, the STRS staff itself, they've got a lot of very highly paid employees. They've got these so-called alternative investments that are pretty high-fee vehicles. They paid out over $1 billion in fees on these alternative investments. So I think that this is something that people want control over, and I can understand why the retired teachers would be upset about being locked out of that process.
This is going to, shifting the control of the board to political appointees, it takes away the voice and the power that teachers and retirees have over their own pension systems. And, you know, the way the boards are structured in the other public pension systems, the workers have a pretty significant say and control over what happens with their pension systems.
All right. I guess we'll leave it there for now and we'll see what happens. Coming up, we are going to discuss how labor unions are already making endorsements in the governor and Senate races and what impact that might have. That's when the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Durovich. Still with us, Laura Bischoff, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, and Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Workers and their unions are a powerful force in elections, and we've seen a large swath of members flip from Democrat to Republican in recent years, and a part of that is what helped President Trump win his second term. So how are unions lining up here when it comes to both the governor's race and the race for Senate? Because I guess we could start with Senate, because Sherrod Brown has been known for his partnerships with unions. I don't know what word to use. Marty, what do you make of these union endorsements that are coming out?
Well, it sounds to me like they're trying to be pragmatic. You know, Brown has definitely had a long, close relationship with unions around the state. He maintained those ties for a long time, and I think there are a lot of warm feelings both ways. But I think other unions who are endorsing Ramaswamy are making the calculation that he's inevitable. And, you know, you want to make friends with the person who's going to be in power as soon as possible. That's what it looks like to me.
You covered a Labor Day rally a few weeks ago at the State House that brought out about 300 people. One sign read, workers make, billionaires take. And you wrote a story that put the issue from today into some historical context. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Labor Day goes back to the other Gilded Age when, people were working in bad conditions, long weeks, really poor pay. And the decision was made that the only way that we can have any power is if we band together. And we're in a different time now, and I think people are, you know, getting information from other sources. But I do think that if you conducted a poll and asked, you know, who do you have more sympathy for, people who, you know, work with their hands or people who have $1 billion, I think I know how that poll would go. I think just a matter of how these politics work themselves out.
Laura, the idea of unions endorsing already, is this early? Is this normal, like, for unions to come out with endorsements before everything seems set with the candidates?
Well, I think the only thing that's a little odd about this is that the plumbers and pipe fitters, which is, you know, tends to be more lean more liberal, that they decided not to wait on Tim Ryan. They see the writing on the wall that Vivek Ramaswamy has, you know, is picking up steam. And, you know, I think, you know, that part's a little unusual. Mm-hmm. I think Marty's right. It's sort of like they want to be friends with who they think is going to win. And this is one way of doing it.
Hmm. Does anyone ever change their endorsement? Like, once you endorse, are you set?
Yeah, I think it doesn't really hold the same weight if you endorse somebody and think you might unendorse them in the future. So usually what these endorsements mean are money. So I'm guessing that there's been money that's already changed. You know, I guess saying changed hands makes it sound bad. Like, they've already cut checks and made political contributions to these candidates they've endorsed. But some of these unions, you know, we've seen a couple of the local building trades councils in Toledo and Cleveland endorse Ramaswamy. And those organizations are pretty important with kind of local campaigning and getting members to mobilize and vote. And again, like, canvas and stuff like that. So yeah, these things can matter, but I really would be really surprised if they change their minds just because Tim Ryan gets in the race or something like that. So.
Well, and Sherrod Brown versus endorsing John Husted versus endorsing Sherrod Brown, that if Sherrod Brown got, because Ramaswamy and Amy Acton both haven't run before, so, right? So Sherrod Brown has passed endorsements that you can look at to see if anyone has changed hands. I don't know that they have, but that would be significant if someone picked Husted over Brown.
Yeah, so the Toledo, just off the top of my head, the Toledo Building Trades Council did endorse Husted over Brown. They've endorsed Brown previously, and that was pretty significant. And generally speaking, building trades tend to kind of be more pragmatic. They often so it used to be that the unions all just had very close ties with the Democratic Party. That's frayed over the years, and kind of what's been the status quo more recently is that building trades have had relationships with local governments that, you know, set policies that basically, like, let's build a new Cleveland Brown Stadium, for example. And then there's lots of construction jobs associated with things like that. And now we're sort of seeing this pragmatism from those people shift towards who's going to run the state and say, like, build new highways or what have you. So it's been a drift, but it is really significant, especially that Sherrod Brown has been missing out on some of these because of his historical connections that he's had, being one of those legacy Democratic Party politicians, especially.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll see who endorses who next. Laura, I wanted to pivot to an update related to an investigative series that you did on vicious dogs. Stephanie Ayers, the owner of Chew Dogs, that severely disfigured an 11-year-old Columbus girl, could spend a few days in jail. Can you give us an update here?
Yeah. So Stephanie Ayers owned two pit bulls, adult pit bulls, and some puppy pit bulls that attacked Avery Russell in June of 2024. She lost both her ears, had significant disfigurement of her face and her neck, and the psychological trauma, it was enormous. And despite the severity of this attack, Stephanie Ayers only faced misdemeanor charges in municipal court, and she had faced a maximum fine of $850 and 30 days in jail. She got $450 in fine and 30 days in jail with 26 suspended. That means she will not have to serve those 26 days as long as she abides by her probation requirements. Also, the police who arrived on the scene shot and killed one of the dogs right then and there, and the other dog was impounded, racking up like a $9,000 impound bill to the county. That second dog was put down last week. This project and these cases, including the Eichelbarger case in Pickaway County, that was a horrible fatality of a 73-year-old Joanne Eichelbarger. Those those cases have prompted these reform bills that are now pending in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the chairman of the committee expects to start some hearings as soon as the Senate comes back in the next week or two.
In the Eichelberger case, the sentence was much more severe than this case that you just talked about here in Franklin County, right?
Right, because one of the dogs had previously attacked and injured a neighbor and had some other issues and had been ticketed multiple times. And the owners of those dogs were charged with involuntary manslaughter. Mm. And they got, I think, 14 years in prison. It was a mother and son who owned the two dogs.
Okay, so it all stems from what the charge was at the beginning, right?
Right.
So the case with the Russells, did you get a chance to ask them about their reaction to it? Or,
yeah, I don't think they're very happy with this. Mm-hmm. The family and the prosecutors from Reynoldsburg City Attorney's Office asked for the maximum, and actually they had asked that like 2 weeks of the 30 days. The prosecutor asked that be suspended. So that they could also impose a 5-year no animal ownership requirement. Mm. And it was very fuzzy in court the other day because there was some, under the terms of the 3-year probation, there was like a requirement that she not own any companion animals except for one dog that she already had, and then the prosecutor's office is like, wait, what dog and what breed? And so there was a little bit of confusion.
Okay, so it's not clear whether she's allowed to own animals at the moment.
I think she's only going to be allowed to have this one.
The one that she already had.
Right.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. And with us, Laura Bischoff of the Columbus Dispatch, Marty Schladen of the Ohio Capital Journal, and Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio. Andrew, you wrote about Portsmouth in southern Ohio. For years, it's been regarded as the epicenter of the opioid epidemic. Now it is known for addiction recovery. Tell me about your piece and how the community is responding to that shift of being the center of the epidemic and now the center for recovery.
Yeah, there's different facets to kind of the recovery industry, if you want to call it that. But the big issue for leaders in Portsmouth is what's called recovery homes. These are often just regular houses that businesses or, you know, nonprofits, I guess, also have bought and convert into transitional housing for people who are out of inpatient addiction treatment, but who are still in treatment, trying to get their feet back under them and stuff like that. And the problem that the proliferation of these recovery homes has caused in Portsmouth is that there are so many of them that they're sort of like the not in my backyard problem, where I bought my house and their family's here and now there's 8 people in a recovery home and I don't like that. That changes kind of the way that my neighborhood feels. But the bigger problem is that there are just so many of them that are being bought that the local officials don't have the resources to adequately enforce, you know, like poor conditions, kind of like slumward type stuff. There are not houses available for people who want to buy them and be able to, you know, it's driving up housing costs. This is more disputed, but officials believe that it contributes to homelessness because people are being sent there. You know, they're being ordered to go through addiction treatment as a condition of a criminal sentence. There's available housing in recovery housing in Portsmouth, so they get sent there, they fail treatment, and they can't get home. Like, people think that that's happening and that there are people who are living on the streets because of that. So there is a bill in the legislature that would essentially create a local funding stream by licensing these recovery homes, but that has opposition from advocates who think it would just kind of tighten the availability of housing across the state where they don't have the kinds of problems like what they're seeing in Portsmouth. It seems like there's more of these in Portsmouth because of kind of the history of addiction and, you know, availability of Medicaid enrollment and stuff like that. So it's pretty complicated, but it is an interesting kind of look into how the epidemic, the opioid epidemic from the 2000s, just continues to have, you know, reverberation 20 years later and what that means for policymakers.
And I did a show about how opioid settlement money is being used throughout the state. Is any opioid settlement money being used to pay for these homes in Portsmouth? Do you know?
Generally speaking, the houses don't get government funding, so I'm doubtful that that's the case. Where it becomes kind of tied to the government is that people who are In treatment, often the providers that provide the housing also provide the treatment, and so the treatment can bill Medicaid. So I'm a little bit unclear about the connection there actually, but generally speaking, it's not totally like a government issue per se when it comes to how these houses are run, because they're often run by private entities.
All right. Well, we are out of time. That has been the reporter roundtable for today. I want to say thank you to Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Thanks, Andrew.
It's my pleasure.
Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal. Thanks, Marty.
Thank you.
And Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And again, now more than ever, we need to put politics in its place. We need to put hyper partisanship aside and the heated rhetoric aside, and we need to have a civil discussion. And frankly, we need a beer. That's why WOSU is hosting another Politics and a Pint. You can join me and Mike Thompson and a couple of Statehouse vets to discuss all things politics. Our next event is Thursday, October 2nd at 7th Sun Brewing. That's on North 4th Street. You can register at WOSU.org/events. And this has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.